S-A-P-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shimma, shimma. Shimma, shimma. Shimma, shimma.
Let me in.
Shimma, shimma.
I want to be closer to you.
Shimma, shimma.
Open up your soul.
Shimma, shimma.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your love.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or in the case of Scintillating Science Monday, understand something. It's the first Monday of the month, and you know what that means. I have our science envoy from Wonderfest here to talk about a wide variety of science topics that are all equally fascinating to me. I'd like to welcome Josh Tong. Hi.
Hi. Happy Monday. Thanks for having me.
Happy Monday to you. So, Josh, tell me, before we get started, when did you first become interested in science?
Well, I think you would say, my parents would say, from a young age, mm-hmm. I would be interested in, you know, watching things like Discovery Channel mm-hmm. or YouTube videos, science YouTube videos, mm-hmm. or I think in science classes, I was always really interested in, like, weird things that would happen, like, you know, when you would put cornstarch in water and it would be solid when you hit it one way, but liquid when you mix it. So
okay.
Kind of strange behaviors. And that's like making models to understand kind of weird behaviors that come up and you don't quite understand.
So did you have really good science teachers growing up?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I'm from Trinidad. Both my parents are from Trinidad uh-huh. in the Caribbean.
Okay.
And I went to school in the Middle East and had really good science and math education and good access to A-levels. So A-levels is a type of exam that you do at the end mm-hmm. of high school. Mm-hmm. So you do kind of AP level math and science. And so that I really took to that and wanted to do more of that when I went to college.
So when you went to college, did you go right into the sciences or was it sort of a circuitous route?
Yeah, I went straight in. I did physics and math from the get-go at uh-huh. NYU when uh-huh. I went and kept on going. And then I went kind of deeper into physics as I went there. I did some physics research, applied math research, and mm-hmm. Now I'm here in San Francisco, or I'm at Stanford doing physics research.
Okay.
My PhD is in theoretical physics.
Very cool.
In dark matter.
And all of that because of cornstarch's weird properties.
Yeah, it take me on a crazy journey, but...
Okay, so when I was looking at the wide range of topics you've studied, mm-hmm. one of them you studied spiky landforms and icebergs.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So part of the research I did as I was an undergrad with a team at NYU in the mm-hmm. Applied Math Lab mm-hmm. is we looked into how solids dissolve and how ice melts.
Okay.
So it's an applied math lab. Usually you wouldn't think about, you know, a lab where you do experiments for math. You might think of it like you're doing proofs and you're just at a chalkboard. But mm-hmm. this lab is all about, you know, soap bubbles as ideal shapes and dissolving bodies and mm-hmm. as kind of these shapes that come from the fluid dynamical equations that,
okay.
that govern them.
Okay.
So we're doing experiments in the lab dissolving candy blocks. And these
candy,
right?
Oh, okay.
Like we make candy in the lab, and
all right.
Like your standard candy recipe you find online. Like you're mixing sugar and cornstarch and water together and mm-hmm. boiling it mm-hmm. until it reaches a certain hot temperature, mm-hmm. so that it gets hard enough, and you let it set.
Okay, like a caramel.
So, yeah. So after you've let it set, you can. Pour it, before you've let it set, you've poured it into a mold and you
uh-huh.
want to mold it into different shapes
okay.
before you do an experiment
okay.
on the candy.
Uh-huh.
And you'll leave it in water, in a tank of water, and observe and take pictures of how it dissolves.
Now, when you put it in the tank of water, does it kind of move like a jellyfish, or does it, how does it?
Good question. For our experiments, we kept it static, so we held it, hold it in position,
okay,
and just watch it evolve because it's dissolving, and the fact that it's dissolving, the particles, like the candy particles,
mm-hmm,
get absorbed into the water and make the water right outside the candy heavier than the surrounding liquid because its density increases.
Okay.
So the density increases right outside the candy's body, and mm-hmm, that fluid sinks. And as that fluid sinks, it kind of like licks the candy into this spiky shape. So that's something we found in the lab, is that you just put a piece of candy in a mm-hmm, in a tank, and it kind of sculpts itself into interesting shapes resemble landforms and icebergs.
Is that why you were using candy to try and mimic what
good
happens
question.
In Earth? Or?
Yeah, landscapes are dissolve over time, over much longer time scales than candy.
Okay.
So it would be hard to do experiments in the lab with limestone and sit there for maybe a million years and watch that dissolve. So we can use candy as a stand-in for a rock that dissolves much faster, and the process goes much quicker, but mm-hmm, the way we would describe the evolution of limestone and candy are similar.
Okay.
So that's why we can use candy instead of rock.
Okay, so then when you take that candy mm-hmm, data and you extrapolate it to what limestone is doing, what rocks are doing, what does it tell you?
So what we found is that if you have these candy blocks mm-hmm, with pores as an initial condition, so you imagine kind of these it's porous so that fluid can flow through it, flow down.
Mm-hmm.
The water initially starts flowing down these pores and starts to widen pores in this candy block.
Okay.
And this like first candy block that has arrays of holes in it starts to turn into hills, which reminds you of like limestone landscapes with hills on them. And then these hills erode away further into arrays of spikes,
mm-hmm,
and these spikes get revealed after the flow carves them away.
Okay.
And we found that looks similar to limestone landscapes like you'd see in Madagascar. They're called karst pinnacle landscapes.
Okay.
And so we connected our experiments that we did in the lab with these real natural formations that people hadn't really looked into, the maybe a simple physical mechanism that could mm-hmm, get these sharp spikes to evolve from just the simple initial condition of water and candy and allowing itself to be sculpted into spiky shapes.
Okay. Then with that in mind, do you have variations? Because, you know, for example, you've got volcanoes. So
right,
how do you mimic volcanoes, or is that even part of the scope?
So that would be that's a good point, in that our setup was deliberately very simple. It was a highly simplified situation
mm-hmm,
of the real world, where there are volcanoes and there are ocean currents, and limestone is a material made up of different chemicals, and it's not the same as candy. So a lot of those things we didn't take into account in our experiments mm-hmm, or our modeling, but we were interested in, I guess, a simple physical principle that can give you these spiky shapes. And then the complexities that you added on top would, I guess, give you more details for the specific landscape that you're interested in explaining its evolution and how it came to form and why it looks the way it does specifically.
And then when you're making these candy models and watching them dissolve, was there a point where all of it dissolved and you could extrapolate to, this is when all of the land on the planet's going to disappear?
Oh, good question. I think what we see in the lab is the towers, the spiky candy landscapes that we made
mm-hmm,
start to topple over. You know, they kind of fall on top of each other, they die, and they dissolve away.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only if they remain inside the water. So what we see right now is that the landscapes, the solid limestone landscapes, are not in the water anymore. So they're kind of like just preserved in time. They're not eroding as much as if they would be, you know, underwater like they could have been millennia ago.
Okay, so that's the spiky landscapes. Mm-hmm. Then talk about the icebergs.
All right, the icebergs were a follow-up that we did after our experiments with candy. Mm-hmm. We thought of ice as an interesting follow-up to move on to because it has interesting properties when it's really cold.
Okay.
I think you might know when ice is close to freezing, it's actually less dense. I mean, ice is less dense than the water around it.
Okay.
So, right, ice floats in water, which is unusual for most solids. Most solids are heavier than their liquid form, so they mm-hmm. would sink. Mm-hmm. Like a solid metal would be more dense than its liquid form.
Okay.
But ice actually is less dense and floats in water.
Why?
Good question. That's because the ice molecules start to separate as they freeze.
Oh.
So they push each other away and take up more space. So they actually, for the same number of molecules, take up more space than water does. So they'll float.
Okay, then this might be a dumb question. So
yeah.
You have water molecules. Are they more liquid and then ice molecules are more of like a solid? Like can water molecules sort of squish in with each other?
Exactly, yeah. Water molecules are free and flow past each other,
okay.
Whereas the solid molecules are fixed and bound together.
And do they take on a specific shape? Whereas it seems like water molecules might be sort of malleable.
Yeah, yeah. So they take on a specific crystal shape, and water molecules are all over the place and malleable and flexible.
Okay.
And they feel the interactions between each other. That's why the liquid isn't a gas. They're not mm-hmm. Spread out across the room. The liquid is still contained in your container
because mm-hmm.
they still feel those interactions, but not as strongly as ice would, if that makes sense.
Yes. It actually does. So what was it that you were hoping to, or what was it that the experiment was set up to find out with when you were looking at icebergs?
So we would... one of the challenges we had for a long time is finding a good candidate to study, a good ice candidate.
Mm-hmm.
That took a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But once we had a candidate of ice that was clear and clean and crisp, we couldn't study anything that had bubbles or imperfections in it because we wanted to study the interaction between water and ice, not its interaction between water and bubbles that come out of ice or anything complicated or anything that would mess up this really idealized situation that we wanted to study.
Okay.
So we had a challenge and a lot of work into making this clear ice samples that we could study.
Uh-huh.
And once we had these, we also had the challenge of finding how do you visualize it? How do you see the ice when it's in water and melting? Because it turns out when you make really like perfect ice, it's invisible when you put it inside of water.
You
put it in a tank, and it's the light passes straight through the tank and straight through the ice, and you can't see the ice at all.
So you're saying that like when I make an ice cube and
right.
throw it in the water, the
yeah.
reason I'm able to see the ice cube is because of all of the imperfections,
all the bubbles and gas,
and
that's
minerals and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So then if the natural state of ice is imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
What is the value of studying the perfect form since that doesn't really occur in nature, or does it?
Oh, that's a really good question. The perfect form you can see it in nature. If you ever go to maybe a lake that's frozen over, you'll see mm-hmm. the cap of ice on the lake is mostly crystal clear water. It starts to freeze clear, and imperfections the imperfections and gas starts to build up as ice freezes, and then all of a sudden you'll see lots of gas bubbles and imperfections in a layer of ice.
Okay.
So there are layers of ice that are clear in nature that melt and have patterns and that look sculpted that we can try to recreate in the lab.
But are they truly pure? Because if they're in a lake is affected by like the flow from land and whatever particles are in the rain. I mean, is it really pure?
So it's not. It wouldn't be pure like it would be in our lab. I think again, our study would be of an idealized ice and not of the ice in nature, and that
okay.
the shapes and sculptures that you see of ice on icebergs and ice landscapes mm-hmm. would be more complex because they have this additional fact that they're real. It's real ice that was made in nature and not the stuff we made in the lab. But still, it would be that those principles of how pure ice and pure water interact mm-hmm. are still there. They still influence how ice and water interact in the world with all of the other factors involved as well.
Okay. So when you put this ice in the water, are you watching how quickly it melts? Or are you just watching, you know, what it does?
So we were interested in what it does, in the shape that the ice takes as it melts. Mm-hmm. And another interesting fact about how water behaves when its temperature changes mm-hmm. is that you raise the temperature and its density increases when you're raising the temperature of water from 0 to 4 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You're
I know.
Celsius.
As a scientist, I'm thinking in Celsius and Kelvin. But just a few degrees after the freezing point, it increases in density, which is really weird for a material.
Okay.
Which means that the warmer water is heavier than the surrounding, which means it sinks. That's weird because you think of hot gases as rising. You know,
okay.
You think of typically we think about heating air and the hot air rises, and mm-hmm. that's why the top floors of buildings are too warm and the cold floors are cool.
Uh-huh.
So that's the kind of behavior we expect from fluids or gases.
But
in water, it's different at that regime.
The warm water sinks.
The warm
and
water
the
sinks.
Cold water moves up to the top.
Yeah, exactly.
And then as that warm water is sinking, is it taking part of the, like, what's happening with the ice?
Great. So what happens then is that the warm water is rising,
mm-hmm.
The cold water is sinking, and the movement of the fluid, we think, sets up these vortices that sculpt these scallop shapes into mm-hmm. the ice. So what you see when you do an experiment, when the block of ice is set in water near this temperature, is you don't see spikes at this temperature like we saw with dissolving candy. We actually see these caves being dug into the side of the ice,
okay.
which is totally this behavior that hadn't been seen before of melting ice.
So when the ice is being sculpted and you have like this blob of
yeah.
formerly ice, now super
it's
cold
all,
water.
It's all caves and yeah.
Okay. But you have the part that was sculpted out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part that's sculpted out kind of hanging together, or is it just sort of dispersing? What's mm-hmm. happening with that part that's being removed?
The part that's being removed, it's being removed because of these flows that I mentioned. The
uh-huh.
flows that are being set up by the rising and sinking fluid sets up these circular flows that carve out caves in the side of the ice. So it's like the flow flowing up and down past the side of the ice
mm-hmm.
melt water faster in some areas and slower in others. And that's why you have this undulating shape on the side of the ice at this temperature.
Okay. So that's why when you're like looking at water and ice in your cup, they melt in these sort of weird, and then you get the little holes in them.
Right.
Stuff.
If you look at ice cubes in your glass really carefully, you can see the reflection of light shows you these patterns in the water as the ice is melting. And so those are the patterns that really dominate the shape of the ice actually as it's melting.
Mm-hmm.
Those patterns leave their influence on the ice. They can tell you, you know, what temperature the liquid was, and
mm-hmm.
the shape of the ice can tell you what regime it's melting in. So that was very cool to see that the shape of the ice can tell you many things about the water that you weren't measuring precisely or directly.
So then, and this is an aside question, which
mm-hmm.
is, so you're doing this thing where you're melting candy and you're watching
ice,
and then you go home to see your folks and they're like,
yeah.
what are you doing, son? And you're like, well,
yeah.
what do you, when you tell them what you're doing, are they as fascinated as I am, or do they just kind of look at you like, is this the state of science?
I think the reactions really can, their reactions go go both ways. Mm-hmm. Like some people are really interested, and some people are like, "Well, how is that? How does that make any sense? Why are you looking into that? Why do you why do you care about that?" Yeah, yeah. So I think I have a larger family. I have many cousins, and my grandma is one of 10 siblings, I think, or one of 9 siblings. Uh-huh. And at family gatherings, there's lots of people. So naturally, is when I talk about what I do, it's like, oh, that's good for you. Yeah, good for you. I think, I'm excited that I think some of it can relate to also what they're doing with their life.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We are speaking with Josh Tong about all kinds of science stuff. I'm going to get to what you're studying pretty soon.
Perfect.
But I saw the word qubits, and the only way I know of qubits is like how they measured Noah's Ark, and that can't possibly be right. So what's a qubit? Or am I even saying it right?
Qubits, yeah.
Oh, okay.
After I had done research with ice and candy, I had done some research on qubits and how you build qubits to make a quantum computer.
Now, what's a qubit?
A qubit is like a bit in your regular computer. A regular bit has a state of 1 or 0, and it's a device in your computer that flips from 1 to 0 and does these operations. Okay. It's like to be like a calculator to process the information that the software is sending to the bit that's either in 1 or 0.
Are they little like microchips or what are they?
Right, little devices in the microchip in your computer.
Okay,
and then
about how big, like. Because I've heard that they're microchips that you can only see under a microscope.
Yeah, like tiny scale, like microscopes. You need powerful microscopes to see. For qubits, I think they're larger than modern microchips, than bits in modern microchips. Uh-huh. The qubit scale might be a few, like a millimeter or something, small. But then bits in your phone are nanometers, maybe 100 times smaller, 1,000 times smaller.
See, I can't wrap my brain around something so small that you would lose it in a microscope, and yet it is some sort of machine.
Right.
How does that work?
Just a tiny device. The bits, they're really small, but they're engineered with a lot of precision.
But
so they have devices.
Something so mm-hmm. infinitesimally small.
Oh, that's an excellent question. You'll have devices that for a qubit etch the. So I'll back up. A qubit is made with by etching shapes into. Material that into a superconducting material, and so you etch these shapes into the material, and when you conduct a current through the material, through the shapes you've etched, they interact and resonate in ways like only they interact and resonate in ways that's quantum, because you've cooled the material down. You've put it inside of a fridge and cooled it down to its superconducting temperature, where the electrons flow without any resistance.
Oh, how can electrons flow without any resistance over something that actually exists?
Oh, great! The material has this property called superconductivity.
And what does that mean?
Oh, great! It's like when the electrons pair up in the material, they have they pair up into this configuration called Cooper pairs.
Okay.
And because the electrons are in this pair when the metal is cold, it's like they don't experience the resistance from the atoms inside of the metal anymore. So it's like the electrons have gone from a phase from liquid to gas, so they've changed phase to a different form, and they don't feel the resistance in
so
the metal
like
anymore.
So they kind of float through.
Exactly, right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we've got, okay, so it is kind of like Noah's Ark, because they're pairing up
to march forward. Like getting on the arc,
yeah.
And then to either be a zero or a one. It just blows my mind that you can etch something on something so small because, mm-hmm. you know, I don't understand how things can move so infinitesimally to make it something.
Yeah, it's crazy that the scale is visible, too. You can look at the qubits mm-hmm. in a microscope, and it kind of blows my mind that those things can have the properties of the quantum world, even though they're, you know, visible under a microscope. They won't have those quantum properties when they're under the microscope, but when you put them in the fridge and cool them down to extremely cold temperatures, then they would. Okay. And they'll have these properties that you could put the qubits into these states of what you'd call superposition, where they're mm-hmm. in not zero or one, but in some mixed state between zero and one, and taking advantage of that to do computations different from a classical computer. And then you can see those qubits when you look at them under a microscope. You can see those things, and you it's unbelievable. Like all those things that we etched can mm-hmm. can have these properties that are just mind blowing, right?
Okay, I've got like now we're finally getting to what you're doing right now because mm-hmm. this is okay. So for our listening audience, what is quantum?
Oh, what is quantum? That's an excellent question. I think for
me.
I think for scientists or for quantum physicists, mm-hmm. quantum would mean behaves by the rules of quantum mechanics. So what I mean by that is that you have these effects like superposition, and you have these effects like I'll dive deeper into these superposition and interference. So when something's quantum, you can think of the experiment like a particle being in a state of zero or one or a mixed state of in between. Mm-hmm. Something that's quantum can be in that mixed state, right? Whereas classical physics is not about about things in superpositions of states mm-hmm. at once.
So would you say that like something that's quantum would be like when water is transitioning from ice to water, that weird in between state before
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that you would classify that overall transition as quantum behavior. It's true that the atoms are behaving with the laws of quantum mechanics.
Okay.
But you could describe the transition of ice to water without thinking about quantum effects. But why we would say something is really a quantum effect is that you'd have to take into account the fact that a particle is either in a state of one or zero or a mixed state. For example, a particle that's magnetic field is aligned with the external magnetic field that an experimenter puts up.
Okay.
So a classical quantum experiment is that you have a particle mm-hmm. and it's being sent through a magnetic field.
Okay.
And the particle has its own magnetic field that points up or down, like zero or one.
Okay.
But, right, it's actually in this state, before you measure it, that it's in a superposition. It's anywhere it wants to be, between zero and one, the particle's magnetic field.
So when you say it's in a superposition...
Right.
I almost have it, but I don't quite. So
okay.
You have this thing mm-hmm. that can be a negative or a positive, mm-hmm. and as it's traveling, that superposition means you don't know where, like it's constantly changing, so you don't know what it is.
It's like it's half one and half zero at the same time before you've observed it. I think I've heard it described like when you're flipping a coin, the coin in the air, if you haven't observed it yet, mm-hmm. it's in this place where you're not sure whether it's
okay.
It's heads up or heads down.
That I can understand.
You're thinking, okay, before I've measured it, all I know is that there's some probability it's heads up. Some probability it's heads down.
God, okay, that makes sense to
right.
me. Like it's in this, you don't know what's, it could be in any of these states, and until you measure it, until it's landed or whatever. You yeah. don't know what it is. So it can yeah. be all of these things.
Yeah, that's okay. how the electron is just kind of you're unsure of what state it's in before you've measured it.
Okay.
And what we know is that a particle doesn't really it's not really like the coin in between. So it's kind of, you have to take a leap where it's different from the classical world, where mm-hmm. there really is this state where it's kind of up and down at the same mm-hmm. time.
Yeah.
And then when you measure it, the electron or the particle with the magnetic field interacts with your experiment. You found that it either has up or down, one or zero. But before it had the state of being in between, you mm-hmm. might think that it would have this spectrum of being up or down. It might be in the middle, it might be kind of up, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. but no, you find that it's in this mixed state, and then when you decide to measure it, it really is either up or down. So you have the final experiment where it's discrete, but its initial state was quantum.
Okay. Is it because it's so small that it can occupy both states because it's happening so quickly?
Oh, I'm not sure if it's because it's small, but it goes to a good analogy in that you think of something as quantum when its size gets small enough, mm-hmm, compared to its de Broglie wavelength, which is so when the de Broglie wavelength of a particle gets large, then you consider it a quantum particle.
What's a de Broglie wavelength?
Can you tell?
I took science here.
I don't recall. I should remember what the
is it named after
means.
A person? Or?
Yeah, de Broglie was a quantum physicist around the 1920s and studying the interactions of particles through mm-hmm. through his experimental apparatus, which was a slit through a piece of metal.
Okay.
So you're imagining like a plate of metal with a slit through it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then when you shoot the electron through this hole in the metal, it has this behavior where it behaves kind of like a wave. So the wavelength is kind of like the characteristic size of that hole that you need to make so that the particle you're sending at it behaves like a wave.
Okay. Okay, okay, okay.
So it's like the wavelength is the length of the length of that hole that you're sending a particle through where it acts quantum and has these wave-like properties.
Now, when you're sending that particle through, do any other particles tag along and that they maybe didn't notice when mm-hmm. they, you know, back in the 20s, but now they're going, oh, yeah, these four things are there, too, that we just now been able to measure.
Oh, cool. There have been... in our particle experiments, we've been measuring more accurately things like the magnetic field of mm-hmm. of muon, which is related to in the family of an electron. Mm-hmm. It's a heavier. It's like a heavier cousin to an electron.
Muon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And see, they've added things to science since I went to school. So, was a muon? You said it's heavier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a heavier electron. It has similar properties to an electron. Electron is a fundamental particle of nature that has a charge of -1, and it has a small mass. And maybe a thousandth of the mass of an atom, or I might be wrong about that, but really small mass. But a muon is like an electron, that it has a negative charge, mm-hmm. but it's heavier. And you can excite an electron to be in the state of a muon.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of related by being able to be excited and giving off these other particles called neutrinos,
mm-hmm.
which are also in this family called the weak force that we started to discover, that scientists started to discover, I think, around the 1960s, to add to the forces that you're familiar with, like magnetic forces mm-hmm. and forces of the electric field. There are forces that we studied at particle accelerators and of particles at small scales that mean their behavior can decay to other particles and change flavors mm-hmm. and do all sorts of interesting stuff.
So you were looking at like super microscopic things, and mm-hmm. but you're also searching for dark matter, which to me is like the complete opposite. It's like this, because the universe is expanding and things are getting bigger, and it's also like this density of material.
Yeah.
So what led you to go from quantum to dark matter?
Oh, cool. Well, dark matter, as we the history of how dark matter came to be in the field where particle physicists can study it, was kind of a long journey. There was
You go on, you need to tell my listening audience what dark matter is, or remind.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. Yes, dark matter is a material that's out there that we know of, and the best evidence that we know it's that we think it's a particle is that it kind of holds galaxies together.
Okay.
It, if it comes from the Big Bang or the start of all the other particles in the universe, then it must have been heavy like a particle, and it must have been slow.
Okay.
So that means it was slow enough to collapse and form the seeds of galaxies before galaxies formed.
Okay.
So the story is that without dark matter, that galaxies couldn't come together under their own weight to form stars and do all of their thing.
Okay, and is it called dark matter just because people don't know what it is, or why is it called dark matter?
It's called dark matter because it's invisible. We know it's heavy, but we don't know if it has any interaction with radiation, or if it is bright, if it emits light that we can see in telescopes, or if it reflects light. So we know it's heavy, and we know it doesn't really interact strongly with the electromagnetic spectrum or with visible light. We know it interacts with light, interestingly enough, because it can bend light coming from galaxies that are behind like dense patches of dark matter in the sky.
Okay.
So we can see it bending light because of its mass, because of its heavy influence on light, but we don't know if it interacts with light because it has a magnetic field and scatters the light or absorbs the light like dust would.
Going back to when you talked about how some water is heavier and denser and you can see it moving through, is that the same on a macro scale with dark matter, that it's heavier and you can kind of see?
Right, yeah, like I guess like ice or water flowing in a tank, it'll be really hard to visualize what the flows of the water are doing. And in a similar way, it's hard to see what dark matter is doing directly because it's invisible, and we have to try to come up with ways that we can track it, or see if it's radiating, or see what other interactions it has with us besides it's heavy.
Okay. So you said that dark matter is invisible. So if it's invisible, how do you know it's there? Number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, if you found dark matter, and I'm assuming you...
If I have it, yeah.
Like how big is it?
Mm-hmm.
And is it spherical? Is it sort of an amorphous blob?
Yeah.
What are its properties?
So one was how do we know dark matter exists? If we can't see it, is that we know its influence on galaxies and galaxy clusters and how stars move. So we know its influence indirectly. So we kind of see that stars move in a way that they're influenced by the gravity of dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that clusters of galaxies are the galaxies in these clusters are moving too fast for their own weight to explain why they would be moving that fast.
Mm. So you're saying that the dark matter creates kind of like a gravitational pull that speeds it up.
Right. So the dark matter has its gravitational effect on these clusters of galaxies that wouldn't be able to just be explained by the galaxies alone.
Okay.
And also that, as I mentioned earlier, that they collapse, the dark matter clouds at the early universe collapsed on themselves to provide the gravitational glue for galaxies to stick together. Mm-hmm. And so without the dark matter particles, we think we wouldn't have galaxies.
Okay. So then what shape what do scientists think the shape is, given that it is invisible?
We think that its shape is in a halo that surrounds galaxies,
so like
in
a
this
flat
cloud
disc?
Not like a pancake, but like a spherical like a orb or envelope mm-hmm. that surrounds a galaxy.
So they think it's round.
Right, yeah.
Okay. And not like blobby and floating through like a blob.
The spherical approximation would be a theoretical one, like mm-hmm. an idealized
sure.
dark
sure.
matter cloud around
mm-hmm.
a galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
In the real life, it'll actually have details that it would have wisps and different shape and it actually from simulations cosmologists make it
mm-hmm.
it makes these spheres where a galaxy lives, but between them there is this web of dark matter. Like a net between galaxies.
Oh, okay.
So it's like this. If you've ever seen maybe a map of like moss growing, or if you've mm-hmm. seen like patterns of fungus growing mm-hmm. on trees,
yeah,
like
I've
they look
those.
Kind of like a spider's web.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of have that shape in the galaxy. And then around the galaxies that we're studying as theoretical physicists, we consider that it's basically an idealized sphere with dark matter of a constant density inside of it.
So does that mean that there's lots of pieces of dark matter all throughout?
Right, yeah. So it's like it's dispersed kind of randomly throughout the universe.
And they're not necessarily linked with one another. They're
right.
They just
have their own blobs out there. And they each of the blob is like is where a galaxy
mm-hmm.
might live.
Mm-hmm.
There's the fact that you see galaxies indicates where dark matter is, but it's not like a one-to-one connection where you'll see a galaxy
mm-hmm.
and you'll know dark matter is there, but there's variation in how much, because dark matter might form in a clump and no galaxies will form because of more complicated galactic physics, astrophysics that's
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm. So then let's talk about what they believe the size. What's the
mm-hmm.
scale of a piece of, like an average piece of dark matter?
Like if you maybe try to visualize an individual dark matter particle,
mm-hmm.
we have so much uncertainty about what an individual dark matter particle could be. It could be the mass of an electron or a neutrino, like the lightest things we know of,
uh-huh.
each individual particle.
It could be that incredibly dense and on such a microscopic scale?
It would be light. So it would be, if you have a volume of dark matter around our galaxy,
mm-hmm.
if we know that the Milky Way contains maybe a fixed mass of dark matter.
A single fixed mass?
Like, imagine you measure mass in solar masses, like how heavy the sun is.
Okay.
And our galaxy might have the mass of 100 million solar masses of dark matter.
Okay. Oh.
But if you say that an individual dark matter particle is the mass of an electron, then you'll know, okay, I have one electron mass divided by 150 solar masses. That's a lot of dark matter particles to make up that
right.
entire mass that needs to add together to give that.
But then it's still like I'm envisioning something like that, but it's the size of like a ping pong ball.
Yeah, it'll be tiny, and then there'll
That's
just be a lot of them, lot of them in the Milky Way.
That is
yeah.
just crazy. So, so you're searching for dark matter
mm-hmm.
right now. Where have they found dark matter, and where are they looking for dark matter where they think they're going to find it?
Right. We know where dark matter is directly because of how it bends light
mm-hmm.
From galaxies behind them, so we can see that light is lensed. So we can kind of track dark matter, even though it's hard to do. It's kind of indirect.
Okay.
But we have a good suspicion that it's in the galactic center and all around us. So what we try to do is look for the dark matter that's in the center of our galaxy or that's interacting with our sun. My research is interested in, could dark matter be interacting with the sun or with the Earth or with stars at the center of our galaxies or with exoplanets?
So how do you How do you answer those questions in your research? Like, what's the methodology you're trying to use to get to it?
Our approach is we're envisioning that if the dark matter particle had some interaction, mm-hmm. we could think of ways that interaction could lead to some detection. And the way that we'd see a detection of dark matter indirectly interacting with the sun mm-hmm. is we're trying to see some kind of communication that's going on between a star and dark matter that can't just be explained by the regular physics of a star, by the models that we have for stars that work well.
It suddenly starts to spin more quickly.
It starts to do something strange out of the ordinary.
Okay.
And one of the type of things that could happen is the dark matter could collect in a star. We know it's out there in the galaxy, and what would happen is that it's influenced by the gravity of the star mm-hmm. and gets pulled in because of the star's weight. And if the dark matter interacts, okay. it scatters with the star.
Okay. Okay.
So the dark matter comes in from the galaxy and mm-hmm. scatters off of the sun. Right.
Okay. So does that mean that the particle, you have this ping pong ball yeah. Sized dark matter.
Yeah.
It comes in. Do the particles in it disperse for a while and then reform in another place? Or yeah. is it permanently broken apart?
So why we don't think it's permanently broken apart when that happens is that it's kind of not being accelerated to too high speeds when it comes in from mm-hmm. the halo behind it. If something, there are events where you'd get a particle from the universe, the cosmos, that are really high energy and mm-hmm. that would like lead to showers of high energy radiation in the atmosphere. So that happens, but that's because the particles were really, really fast.
Okay.
Well, what we know about dark matter is that it's slow.
Okay.
So what we think would happen is that it would interact with the star and just like a ping pong table or like a pool, like a pair of pool balls, they mm-hmm. would scatter off of each other.
Oh, okay.
And the dark matter might lose energy and get captured and sit inside of the star.
Oh,
right.
So okay.
Yeah.
And now this star has at its core...
It's like growing this dark matter inside of it.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
So, wait a minute. Sorry, wait a minute.
Yeah.
So you have now a star that's basically pregnant with dark matter. And so is the dark matter now picking up more?
Dark matter.
So is it
growing.
Converting that star into more dark matter?
Yeah, so crazy. When this starts happening, you can think of like dark matter absorbing more and more dark matter from its surroundings as the star picks it up.
Wow.
One thing that's...
So it's almost
that's
like a
been
parasite.
Considered, yeah, it's like it eats the energy away from a star, so it might like take all the star's energy away and might make stars disappear.
Wow.
It might be that the dark matter accumulates inside of the star, and eventually it's so heavy that it turns into a black hole inside of the star and starts to eat the star that way.
Wow.
How
does dark matter interact with planets?
In a similar
stars.
Way, that
really?
They would come in and scatter off of a rock inside of the planet, or it might scatter off of an element in the planet and get captured in the center. Something that people look for is the dark matter coming through and leaving these almost invisible tracks in crystals,
uh-huh.
looking for these tracks that could not be explained by a geological process or a volcano, but dark matter particles coming through and creating these dislocations in crystals in
so
the Earth.
So here on the planet mm-hmm. Earth, are there indications that maybe little pellets of dark matter have traveled through?
So far, we have no direct evidence of dark matter traveling through.
Okay.
We have detectors built to try to look for dark matter.
Uh-huh.
They have... huge containers of heavy gas
uh-huh.
that will interact with the dark matter. And you'll observe this heavy gas and you'll look for any signs that it's being scattered off of, that the dark matter is coming through the container and
okay.
scattering particles inside
okay.
of there. And we haven't seen any signals so far of dark matter interacting.
Is it possible that the core of the Earth is made of dark matter?
That there's dark matter inside of the Earth? Yes. And we go in that direction in some of my research to see if there's dark matter inside of the Earth. And one hypothesis is that they could, that dark matter could annihilate with itself and heat the Earth so that it would be overheated. But we don't see any evidence that the Earth is being heated by dark matter. And so we can kind of rule out models of dark matter from existing because the Earth isn't being heated by dark matter that's out there in the galaxy.
Okay. Well, earlier when you were talking about how dark matter can sort of pass through, I kind of thought of it the way Star Trek, when they have the transporter, it reaches something, it goes and then reforms and just keeps going on its merry way. But then when you kept talking, it was like, oh no, it goes and goes inside and just stays there.
Yeah, it could go inside and stay there, and it could just pass through, like you say. It could not interact and pass through the star completely and not even notice that it was even there.
And does anyone know what will determine, like, because obviously it's not making a choice.
Yeah.
What affects it deciding, or not deciding, what affects it staying versus passing through?
Oh, that's a great question. What would affect it is that interaction that we're looking for between dark matter and us. If dark matter communicates with electrons or has electric charge, for example, it would be attracted to all of the nuclei inside of the sun and would get captured. If it didn't have any interaction, it would just pass straight through. If it was only through gravity, it would come on its orbit inside of the star and then pass through like nothing happened and go back into the galaxy.
Okay. Now, what I know about how media works is they always sort of posit like the doomsday scenario of like with black holes, you'll run into a sliver of black hole and the Earth will be sucked into oblivion.
Yeah.
What is the kind of dark matter doomsday scenario that keeps getting spun that you guys just kind of snicker about and go, that can never happen?
About dark matter that's a doomsday scenario, I think.
You know, or whatever the mass media says, like, here's what's going on, and you're like, calm down, Skippy.
Oh, that's a good question. I think what I see from dark matter in media is that it's kind of more maybe unknown than it really is, or because it's so, the buzzword is so, like, dark matter, it's kind of spooky. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what's going on. It might give the impression that we know, we have no clue what's going on, where we have, you know, we're following breadcrumbs to the evidence to understand what it is. I sometimes get the impression that it could be just anything. It could be, you know, like a cat or a dog, or it could be, you know, whatever anyone can think of. But we have some solid evidence that we're following to learn more about it.
Excellent. Well, this has been fascinating. We're out of time, and I could just ask you question after question after question, but it's time for me to turn the mic over to another DJ. So for people who are interested in your research, how would they go about finding out more?
I think if you find out, you can find out more from, if I were to read the archive, there's papers that are released daily that you can read that anyone has access to. And I think also there are great YouTube videos that you can watch that give you good material about dark matter and good links to read, like, if you got that far, to read textbooks about quantum mechanics and gravity.
And what's the name of the lab that you're doing your research?
I'm doing research at SLAC National Lab at Stanford University, and I work in the theory group at SLAC National Lab.
All right. Well, Josh Tong, it's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the interview.
All right, people of Earth, we've talked about spiky formations. We've talked about icebergs and atoms and qubits and dark matter. It's all fascinating. It's all amazing. Your mind should be filled with questions right now, just filled with questions. I'm very happy that WonderFest is always sending us scientists to talk about amazing things. But you know what else is amazing? Mr. Ford, he'll be pleasuring your ear hole. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.